Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 8th of October 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at Radio Albion because we have with us the Patriarch once again joining us for the 15th episode in our series and we're getting into multicultural Egypt once again today. Patriarch, good day sir, how are you doing?
Hey Sven, very well thanks. Good to be back.
Getting used to being back in the cold and the wet and the misery. I guess it's not too bad, is it? Because you've got the nice gold brown leaves and autumnal
yeah,
weather.
It's not so cold yet, to be honest. Where I live, it's quite near out in some sticks. So I don't know. I think all there's beauty in all seasons, really. I think it's only in a inappropriate clothing and attire that gets you caught out, you know.
Yeah, it's nice to live somewhere where it changes all the time. I did spend some time living near the equator and it's like the days are just 12 hours long, 12 hours daylight, 12 hours night, monsoon season, hot season, and that's about it. There's no real changes, you know. I really missed Britain at the time, actually. It's nothing quite like Britain and how beautiful it is. But again, as tonight, we're going to be talking about multicultural Egypt again. And I've really been looking forward to tonight's episode because we're going to be talking about a piece of papyrus, which is really relevant to multiculturalism and today. And we're going to get into that in a bit. But I just wanted to add a piece to last week's episode before we really got started. And it's another piece about Joseph. Another pointer to Joseph not being with the Hyksos at Avaris and instead being with the actual Egyptians at Thebes is because he could not get word to his family until after all the lands had been taken back for the Pharaoh. The Hyksos had extensive trade routes going to Palestine and Syria, while the Egyptians were trapped in the middle of the country with the Nubians to the south and the Hyksos to the north. So communication from Thebes to Canaan would have been cut off completely for him until the Hyksos had all given the lands back. And if he had been with the Hyksos and it had been a Hyksos pharaoh that he was with, then he could have reached them straight away as soon as he was released from prison. So there's another pointer there that confirms to me that it could not have been the Hyksos that Joseph was with. Have you had any other thoughts on that, on Joseph and the Hyksos from last week, Patriarch?
No, I mean, that's just striking. That's a good point. I just also, when you spoke about them having control over the trade routes, the connection I made was obviously that's kind of evidence that they were from maybe the land of Canaan, you know, because them trade routes were very significant around the land of Canaan, weren't they?
Yeah.
So they would have been the first kind of inhabitants of Canaan at that time and, you know, dominated those trade routes that went across the Horn of Africa and southern Mediterranean.
Yeah, they were the rulers in Canaan at that time because Joseph and his family, they were sojourning there at that time, and that was where that was where Joseph's father was and his brothers were. They were living in Canaan at the time, and Abraham made his way there as well. So the fact he was with with the Egyptians in the middle there at Thebes, he wouldn't have been able to contact them because the Hyksos would have been to the north of him. Whereas if he'd actually been with the Hyksos instead of with the Egyptians at Thebes, he could have contacted his father straight away as soon as he was released from the prison. It's quite interesting because the mainstream narrative is that Joseph had to have been with the Hyksos, and the Hyksos were the Jews, as they say, because most people today seem to think that the Israelites were the Jews, and they think that the Hyksos were Jews, but the Hyksos weren't Israelites at all. And we'll see later on with this papyrus that we're going to get into, lots of people have said, well, that must be talking about the Exodus and that must be talking about Moses. And again, it's not talking about that, but it proves another point of view, which we'll get into. So much of the mainstream narrative is based around trying to prove that today's Jews were doing things with the Israelites, that it's messed up a lot of history, basically, when you look at it. Because those bits that I pointed out last week, it all just comes from reading the Bible and saying, well, if he was marrying this person, that meant she had to have been an Israelite. If the Pharaoh after him knew not Joseph, then that meant that the Pharaoh after him had to have been foreign. And the fact that the Pharaoh did appear to know him, it meant that he was of the same kinship group as him. The fact that the Pharaoh asked for Jacob's father's blessing shows that he had to have been from the same ethnicity. And he also saw Joseph's father as being above him. I mean, all of these things say that he had to have been linked with him. And he can't have been of this foreign group. Do you see what I mean? Because we know the Hyksos are Canaanites. We know that they are Canaanites. And all of those points there that I brought up prove that the Pharaoh that Joseph was with could not have been a Canaanite, because the Canaanites wouldn't have been able to hand away an Israelite woman to him to marry. You know, all of those things exclude the Canaanites from actually being able to do it. So if only people looked at their Bibles, they'd be able to work that out for themselves.
Yeah, I think sometimes a lot of Christians are kind of, they've got these tinted spectacles on. You know, it's like there's a wave of indoctrination which is kind of, you know, layered over people's eyes, and when they read the scriptures in the Bible, it kind of just guides how they perceive the scripture, so they never actually take it for its, you know, correct interpretation. And if they don't understand it, then they'll just move on and gloss over it and then pick out bits that does kind of fit their narrative, and then they just piece them bits together. That's from my experience with people approach scriptures. But yeah, it's, you know, it's always best to have a solid, you know, historical backing as well, because obviously any form of scripture to prove that it's true, the doctrine, it needs to be it needs to correlate with time, with history, you know, it needs to correlate on multiple levels, not just say, oh, you try and fit the world into the Bible. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, you use the Bible as a framework, but they need to cross. They need to correlate and cross over, and you know, you need to be able to form a bridge, don't you?
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll be doing that with this series. We'll be providing a solid basis for history, including bits from the Bible and all different sources from the ancient world. But I think a lot of the time Christians they fail to see the implications of things, like last year in Haaretz, they said that they did DNA tests on Jews and the majority of them were Canaanites, and it was Canaanite DNA that they had, and that I think that just passed by most Christians what the actual implications of that were. It meant that they could not have been Israelites, and yet Christians won't work that out.
Yeah, and also the evangelical view on Israel as well. You know, they seem to think that it's a land, and really it's a people. And yeah, just when you dig deep and deconstruct it all, it's a lot of the Judeo-Christian doctrines are literally just like a big curriculum that's been passed down and taught to generation by generation. Or to kind of fit a narrative which almost ferments this, you know, a new world, you know, which revolves around a certain people that isn't really that people, if you know what I mean.
Well, it's like a fantasy world, because there isn't any historical evidence to back up it actually taking place to the Jews. Because they have this fantasy that it was the Jews, and then when they don't find the evidence for that, they say, well, it must have just been myths, or it must just be stories. And in actual fact, the evidence is there, but it shows that it wasn't the Jews, or it can't have been the Jews. It was white people. Yeah. And really, that's obvious because the descriptions of the Israelites throughout the Old Testament tell us that they were white. It says that they were ruddy, blue-eyed, fair-haired. They blushed in the cheeks. And you've got all this stuff in Jeremiah and Isaiah that's talking about them interbreeding with the Canaanites and no longer being Israelites.
Yeah, it's strange, but like I say, it's literally just doctrine, dogmatic beliefs. People believe more in tradition and dogma than they'd actually do in standing on, you know, truth and reason and what the scriptures actually say. I guess that's where a lot of the Catholics fall short, in my opinion, because it's so hierarchical in its structure and so much emphasis on just dogma that they're kind of scared almost to really embrace anything which falls outside of the church.
Yeah, they fail to see the historical side of it and how it fits in with, you know, with white people, basically. Before we were European, we were in the Near East. And as we were shown, we were in Mesopotamia. We were in the Indus Valley civilization. And there's confirmation of that in the Bible. I mean, this is the first time I've really looked closely at Egypt. And there are new things that are coming to my attention all the time, particularly looking through this this piece, which we're going to be looking at today. Well, as I was saying, that Joseph was in Egypt at this time. It was multicultural. He ended up winning back the lands for the Egyptian pharaoh, but it was still ended up being multicultural after that, because we know because the Israelites ended up being enslaved at some point within 400 years. So Egypt had become multicultural. And from this time, we actually have a prayer by a priest called Ipuwer, which talks about the conflicts that multiculturalism actually caused. And the mainstream narrative today, and a lot of the Judeo-Christians, they look at this and they say, oh, this is talking about the plagues that happened around the time of the Exodus. Now, I've had a look through it, and it doesn't talk about these being plagues or anything like that. It gives the reason why these things were happening, and it was multiculturalism. And it's throughout this prayer, it's talking about the effects of it. And this papyrus that actually contains the prayer, it's been dated to no earlier than the 19th dynasty, which is around 1250 BC. And that is the actual text that was being used. But it's now agreed upon that the text itself is much older. So it was copied again and again and again onto papyrus, and they think now that it dates back to the Middle Kingdom, which is around 1710 BC. And this places it as being written just about the time after Joseph himself was in Egypt. And I think there's even a reference to it to the Israelites, well, not the Israelites, but the Shemites that stayed in Egypt after the Great Pyramid was built. And there's also a reference then to Joseph's family, the Israelites staying in Egypt afterwards as well, and I'll point that out. This text is basically placed somewhere within the 400-year time frame between Joseph and Moses when the Israelites were in Egypt and when it was multicultural. So this sort of fleshes it out, but the way that it talks about what was happening to Egypt, it's so relevant to what's happening to today. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Patriarch, or ask anything about that, say anything about that. I think you're muted.
Yes, yeah, sorry. I've done a little bit of research on the, how do you pronounce it?
Ipuwer.
I thought it was more of a collection of texts that were found, some of which were written by a sage and some by others, and that have various dates on them, because there was one that I found which was pretty much linking it to the Exodus, but you're saying that that's not quite accurate. I mean, is there a chance that they were dated slightly later?
Well, they don't know what the exact date was. They know that it was one guy that was writing it, because that was his name, Ipuwer, and it's the same textual device or the same narrative device that's used throughout it. And it's actually a lot longer than the quotes which I've got. I've got a section from the middle of it that we can quote from. But I mean, he may have written it down like a few papyruses, but it was certainly done by all written down by this one priest, this one scribe, whose name was Ipuwer, and then it was copied 100 years later, because the papyrus would rot, so you would have to have scribes that would repeatedly keep copying out the text so that the next generations had copies of it, because it wasn't clay tablets like they used in Sumer.
Mm.
So that's why there are more copies of it. And there are slight different variations of it, because it was a text that was around for hundreds of years. The version we have, as I say, it comes from 1250 BC, but it may well have first been written around 1700 BC. So 500 years earlier is when it was originally written, and then it had been copied and used to refer to as history, as in this gives an idea of what happened back then in the time of the Middle Kingdom. But they're not exactly sure exactly which dynasty it was. But as I say, you've got a 400 years worth of leeway that Joseph's family were in Egypt for.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, I've got some notes anyway that are worth a read later. Obviously, we're trying to get a rounded perspective on things. So, you know, when we get to that point a little bit on the Exodus, I'll read a few bits, excerpts from what I found, and we can mull over it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, also the thing is the Exodus took place a lot later, because we know we can work out when the Exodus took place from the time of Solomon and Solomon's empire, which we have solid references for. And then we have Josephus that says that the Exodus took place X number of years before Solomon. And you can work it out. So they can work out when the Exodus actually took place, which I think was about 1300 BC.
Yeah, something.
I mean, may have been 1500 BC, but 1500 to 1300. Some people say 1500. Clifton Emmerheiser says 1300 BC. So I think we could probably go for 1400 BC. Because again, you have to refer it to the pharaohs that were alive at the time, or the kings that were alive at the time, because they didn't have the same calendar that we use today. So we couldn't say this took place on exactly this date based on, you know, the amount of times that the sun goes around the earth and whatever the cycle is that the precession of the equinoxes. We can't place it exactly to a yearly date like that. We have to locate at what period in time it was based on which kings were alive at the time. But we can make a fairly solid reference to when Solomon was alive, and then we can work back from there, basically. But yeah, if you can point out the bits that have something to do with the Exodus when they come up, that would be helpful. Yeah. Right, this is the prayer from Ipuwer. As I say, there's a few verses that come before this, but we can't go through all of it because it would take quite a few episodes. He says, "A man regards his son as his enemy. A man of character goes in mourning because of what has happened in the land. Foreigners have become people everywhere." So there's three main bits in that. A man can no longer trust his son. A father can no longer trust his son. So what is his son being taught? I mean, this makes me think of what's going on today in the schools, when children are being taught to disobey their parents. They're being told that they can consent to things that their parents would not consent to them doing. So the son regards the father as the enemy. The son is being turned against the father. It says a man of character goes in mourning because of what has happened in the land. So the sensible people, the men, the honourable men, they are in mourning because of what has happened. And later on it tells us that the fools are really happy about what has happened. And then finally he tells us the reason why. He says foreigners have become people everywhere. And what that means is that foreigners have become citizens, because the Egyptians used to only refer to themselves as being people anybody else that was from a different ethnicity. They were not regarded as people. And that was quite common amongst various ethnicities, not just in the Near East. I think you get the same with the Chinese and with the Japanese, with the Bushmen in Africa. And they will only refer to themselves as people. If you think years ago and you came across somebody else that was from a different ethnicity, they would be speaking a different language. You would not be able to understand them. You would not think that they were the same as you. They may have walked on two legs, but that would be the sort of the only thing that you actually had in common with them. So the Egyptians did not see other people as people. And what's happened here, what he is saying here is the equivalent of foreigners have become citizens. They've become equal citizens to the Egyptians. And this is what's caused this this problem. It's because if the foreigners have become people everywhere. And I think the Judeo-Christians that are trying to link this to the Exodus, they're missing this point. Well, I mean, where does it say in the Exodus about that happening? Multiculturalism. I mean, that's not one of the plagues of the Exodus, is it?
No. It looks like a different text. There's different writings, different texts. So the impression I got was the Epiwo was a series of different texts found, and it wasn't necessarily from the same person. Because, you'll see later, but it reads differently. I don't know if this one has kind of verses, numbered verses at all.
No, they're all verses. It's called the Epiwo text because that's the name of the priest that wrote it. Epiwo is his name. It's called the Prayer of Epiwo or the Admonitions of Epiwo because it's this one priest that is bewailing what's happened to his country. You can look it up on Wikipedia. Okay. You can look it up, get the PDF of it. And the different translations of it, they basically just have a different device at the beginning of each line. And you see this device in the next bit. He says, why really? The face is pale. The bowman is ready. Robbery is everywhere. There is no man of yesterday. So what he's saying there is that the real men, the people that were here before, the real men of the nation, they're no longer there. There's no longer any man that is standing up. The men of yesterday, you've just got this modern mentality, and you've got robbery everywhere, which meant that there wasn't robbery before. And the bowman is ready, which means people are having to defend themselves on the streets. And the face is pale. Well, your face goes pale when the blood runs out of your face, when you're scared of something. So they're not happy the way that they are living, is what I take from that. What do you make of these lines?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, it's definitely reminiscent of some kind of fall and collapse. It's I guess what happens when you get a multicultural nation, and the host and the natives are gonna, suffer them consequences.
He says, why really? The Nile is in flood, but no one ploughs for himself because every man says we do not know what may happen in the land. So what it's saying, no one ploughs for himself because he doesn't know if what he ploughs for himself and what produce that he gets, whether the produce is going to get taken by the robbers, I should imagine. And they don't know what is going to happen. If people are having their goods are being stolen from them and there's no stability and you plant something, there's every chance that somebody's going to steal whatever it is that you've planted. It's like civilization is crumbling here, basically. And I mean, the next one is very similar to today. Why really? Women are dried up and none may conceive. Knum cannot fashion mortals because of the state of the land, which is basically what's going on today with the fertility rate. Our fertility rate, we're not producing enough to reproduce ourselves. And that's what he's saying here. So I guess that might tie in with the last of the plagues of Egypt. No, that was murdering this, them, wasn't this, it? It was killing
this,
them.
This reads like a different occasion, though. I mean, I'll have to read some other bits, which I'm not sure if we're reading from exactly the same script or text.
Right, it's one. You're... It's one long, very long, almost like a poem, is what it is. And this is a section from. It's fairly near the beginning of it. And it repeats itself.
You have to link me the whole thing, and then I'll have to cross-reference it with a source that I have and see.
Well, I sent you the notes. I did send you a copy of it all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading it here, but I can't see the similarities in... this is a poem, right?
It's a prayer of this guy who is lamenting what's happened to his land.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just trying to cross-reference the bits.
And there's about 7 or 8 different copies of it that you can find.
Okay, I'm just going to do a copy and paste search just to see.
And they're all the same. I mean, this one comes from Near Eastern Texts. I forget the name of it. Near Eastern Texts that have something to do with the Bible. Ancient and Near Eastern Texts is the first part of the title to it. It's a long title to the book itself.
Okay, but you've not included it. All of the whole writing in this document, have you?
No, because it would take 5 or 6 episodes to go through. If you type up ancient and Near Eastern text, you'll get the book, which is this is the translation from.
Okay. All right. Well, let's. I guess I'll because I've got a chart here which kind of goes through some of the passages and then links them to some of the Exodus. Scriptures in Genesis, just for comparison. So they might be worth going through some of these bits.
Well, it's not really a lot of help if it's not the notes that I sent over to you.
Yeah, but it's a different. Obviously, it's a different section, isn't it?
Yeah, that's. I would imagine. Yeah.
You know.
It is a long poem. This is the bit at the beginning.
Right.
It says, why really poor men have become the possessors of treasures? He who could not make himself a pair of sandals is now the possessor of riches. Which is pretty obvious, isn't it? People who are not actually capable of doing anything are now the people that are earning lots of money. Again, this, you know, it just... is so reflective of what is actually going on today. People that are not really particularly capable have been promoted into positions of influence and power who don't really know what they're doing. And they're the possessors of the riches, and the people that really know how to do things are at the bottom of society. The people that should be... they should be leading in society, are not leading in society, and we've got people of low character that are the politicians. And what he means by the poor men have become the possessors of treasures is like the robbers have become the possessors of the treasures. People who are not capable of producing things, knowing how to do things, skilled craftsmen, they're now the people that have got the wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, why really many dead are buried in the river? The stream is a tomb, and the embalming place has really become the stream. So they've got lots of dead as well. And a lot of the reason for this is that people were committing suicide. And again, we've got a really high suicide rate today. And then he says, why really nobles are in lamentation while poor men have joy? Every town says, let us banish many from us. So the towns themselves are saying we need to get rid of the people that we actually have in these towns. And you have to remember what it says at the beginning there. Foreigners have become people everywhere. So they've got foreign people that are living amongst them that are basically taking all the wealth. the nobles are in lamentation while the poor men are quite joyful at this, I guess, because they're seeing the collapse of their civilization as being useful to them. I should imagine that's pretty much like when a riot happens, like when there's a Black Lives Matter riot, and then you end up with all the poor people running into the stores and running out with all the goods. So they're quite happy, while you know, the nobles or the people that actually have a stake in society are saying, well, this is terrible. You know, this is destruction that's going on here. You know, I think it was $5 billion worth of damage was done to the stores in America during
$5 billion?
Well, it might be more than that. I thought it was $5 billion was the insurance costs for the damage that was done by burning down the cities for George Floyd last year.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah, it was the most amount of money that's ever gone up in flames in insurance costs for riots. So you got the same thing happening here. He says, why really dirt is throughout the land? There are really none whose clothes are white in these times. And cleanliness is next to godliness. So people are not looking after themselves anymore like they used to. They're not keeping their clothes clean. And I think that's quite interesting as well, because you think, you know, we have washing machines and ways to do our laundry today, and back then they had to do it all by hand, and yet they were still spotless all the time, and they were wearing white. Must have been quite a lot of work to do.
Yeah, no, they had people to do it for them.
Yeah, well, they would have had servants, I guess. But the servants would have kept themselves clean as well. I mean, it's saying dirt is throughout the land. And what do we have now in our cities? You know, rubbish everywhere, litter everywhere. You know, we have a real problem with that. I mean, but back then the city used to be the safe place to be, and outside of the city was the dangerous place to be. It was outside of the city that the vagabonds were and the robbers. And when you were in the city, you were safe, and outside the city walls, you weren't. And now it's the other way around. If you're in the rural areas, you're safe. And if you're in the cities, then you're at risk.
Yeah, because it's just where people need to be, right?
Yeah, well, you need to be in the centre of everything, don't you? And he says, why really? The land spins around as a potter's wheel does. The robber is now the possessor of riches. So he's saying everything's spun around. So the people that were well off before are now the people that are not well off. And the people that were honoured before are now the people that are not honoured. And we used to honour our ancestors, and now we rubbish them all and claim that they were all racists and they were all terrible people. So everything's turned around. So when he's saying the land spins around, he doesn't mean it literally that the land has spinned. I think what he means is like the world has spun around, and it's now upside down. And the position is upside down.
Yeah. Well, I think he uses the potter's wheel as well as maybe someone who, you know, the one who has control or power. Something, maybe that's why that analogy was used. The potter and the clay. You know, he's turned it 360 almost.
Well, yeah, there's the earlier reference as well to the guy fashioning mortals. I guess that probably goes back to this idea of fashioning the mortals out of clay. And that was the legend in Sumer, wasn't it, in Mesopotamia? Originally, I think, fashioning them out of clay, pinch of clay. He says, why really? The river is blood. If one drinks of it, one rejects other humans and thirsts for water. And this was a really difficult one, because the translation didn't really make a lot of sense. So I had to look at another translation, and in another translation made it clear that what it was saying is after somebody is drunk from the river, they didn't want to be around other humans. They tried to avoid other humans. So I had to check another translation to get a proper understanding of this one. So the translations, all, I mean, they're all slightly different, Patriarch, and they all have a different rhetorical device at the beginning. Like this one says why really? And I forget what it was in some of these others that I looked at. But that's a difficult one. It, you know, if you drink of it, you reject other humans and are still thirsting for water. Then maybe that means that the river is polluted because it's got bodies in it. So it's polluted. If you drink of it, you're going to be ill. You're not going to want to be around other humans, and you're still going to be thirsting for water.
Yeah, one drinks as human.
And he says what?
As human.
Yeah, don't want human company. Don't want to be around other humans. I mean, it's hard to work out exactly what he means with that, but.
Unless there's a connection between the river is blood and rejects it as human, maybe there's a mistranslation still, doesn't quite translate properly, but some relation between the blood in the river and other humans.
Yeah, the original bit there said and rejects it as human, or rejects it as humans. And I looked at another translation and it said that... after drinking it, they didn't want to be around other humans. They weren't sociable with other humans. So I thought that sort of fits it better. But yeah, it could be that they were sociable. But then, you know, it doesn't matter what blood it is, whether it's human blood or animal blood, you're not going to want to drink it, really, are you?
No, for sure. But yeah, it's an interesting one, that anyway.
He says, why really? Doors, columns and floor planks are burned up, but the flooring of the palace, life, prosperity, health still remains firm. So he's thankful that things haven't all fallen apart in the palace yet. They've fallen apart elsewhere, but not yet in the palace. And they're having to burn up doors, columns and floor planks. And I mean that's a bit daft, isn't it? Chopping up your furniture because of what? I guess because we hear later on that they weren't able to get cedar from Lebanon. So I guess there was a shortage of wood, so they're literally chopping up their furniture in order to burn it when they need a fire. Yeah, but it's a bit like burning the handle of the axe, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. You need the wood, but how are you going to use it as an axe afterwards?
He says, why really? Crocodiles sink down because of what they have carried off for men go to them of their own accord. So that's how people were committing suicide, is just going to the crocodiles. And I think there's a bit in the Bible, isn't there, about the wicked Pharaoh throwing the Hebrew babies to the crocodiles?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty, yeah. I don't know about that as a choice of suicide, though. I think if I was going to commit, not that I've ever had those thoughts, but you'd want it to be as clinical and quick as possible, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, I can feed myself to a crocodile, or I can take my chances against these heathens.
Yeah, take some poison.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are other ways to go about it. Well, it seems as if it's not just the the heathens or the foreigners that have come in, but there's some kind of treaty with them, with the royal family, is what it seems like to me. Anyway, we'll see when we get to that bit. He says, why really? The desert is spread throughout the land. The gnomes, which are the districts, are destroyed. Barbarians from outside have come to Egypt. There really are no people anywhere. So again, he's repeating what the source of this problem is. Barbarians have come in from the outside, and the people aren't behaving like people anymore. And these people that have come in from the outside, they don't think that they are people anyway.
Yeah.
And again, you can see where it repeats itself, because that's sort of saying the same thing that it was saying at the beginning. It does repeat itself. This bit's interesting. He says, why really? Those who built the pyramids have become farmers. They who were in the ship of the god are charged with forced labor. And this is the bit that I think links in with the descendant of Shem building the Great Pyramid. Because it says they've become farmers, and farming was an abomination to the Egyptians. And yet Joseph was a farmer, and the land that Joseph was given in Goshen was so that he could farm his livestock there. And it's saying here, those who built the pyramids have become farmers. And I think that's who he's talking about, Joseph's people. And he's saying those who are in the ship of the God are charged with forced labor. And whoever it was that was in the ship of the God, I think that was the Pharaoh that was in the ship of the God, or was seen as being in the ship of the God. So that's saying that, that royalty is being charged with forced labor and being forced to work, the rulers of the land.
So this is written before or after Joseph?
I think this is after Joseph, close to the time. I think this is after Joseph and before Moses. Maybe 100 years before Moses, something like that. Okay. But I think it's after Joseph because of this bit, because it's saying those who built the pyramids have become farmers, because Joseph came in there and his people became farmers. They were basically farming there, and they were the descendants of the architect that built the pyramid. Because of course, don't forget, it wasn't actually the Shemites that built the pyramid. They came in there, they designed it, they directed it. And it was the Egyptians themselves that willingly built it for them. They weren't forced to. It wasn't an invasion. It wasn't anything like that. And the Egyptians just built it for them because they just understood that they should be doing this. Or at least that's what we're told. So they who were in the ship of the God are charged with forced labor. No one really sails north to Byblos today. That's in Lebanon. What should we do for cedar for our mummies? Priests were buried with their produce, and nobles were embalmed with the oil thereof as far away as Keftiu, but they come no longer. So the traders that used to come there, they're not interested. The traders aren't coming there anymore. And this is the bit where he says about the cedar. So they can't get hold of any cedar. So I'm guessing maybe that was to do with the burning the furniture earlier. Because they can't get hold of any logs.
There's obviously a big collapse going on. So, it's interesting.
Gold is lacking. How important it now seems when the Oasis people come carrying their festival provisions, reed mats and fresh red met plants of birds. And I'm guessing maybe that's meant to say fresh reed mat plants of birds. And they haven't got any gold, so they're running out of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And they look forward, and they didn't never realize how important it would be when people came in from the outside bringing provisions with them, because they no longer have the provisions within Egypt for themselves.
Mm.
And he says, why really, Elephantine, the Thinite gnome, and the shrine of Upper Egypt do not pay taxes because of civil war? So they're having a war amongst themselves. They've got foreigners in there that have become people, that have been made citizens. And then they've got the people fighting amongst themselves. And so they're not paying taxes.
Mm.
And he says, what is a treasury without its revenue for? The heart of the king must indeed be glad when truth comes to him. But really, every foreign country comes. Such is our water, such is our welfare. What can we do about it? Going to ruin. So he's talking about foreign aid there. So they've got hardly any taxes coming in. They've got no revenue in the treasury, and yet they're still giving out foreign aid. They've got foreign countries that are coming that they're handing it all over to. So it must seem to them as if the king's gone mad doing this.
It just sounds absolutely reminiscent of what's going off today.
Yeah.
You know, like the Afghanis, I've seen the video of what city was it? It's down south somewhere. It was Scarborough. There was all these Afghanis put in this hotel in Scarborough, and they're paying top whack, apparently, these hotels to... you know, to keep these Afghanis in there. And basically you go on, what's that website? we give feedback on TripAdvisor, that's it, and you see all these comments and feedback about these Afghanis in this one particular time frame over the summer. He's talking about Afghanistani kids running about everywhere, totally unruly, you know, just being kind of, you know, just out of control, and the parents not really doing anything, leaving them to their own devices. And then when they would go and complain, the people at reception would accuse them of being racist, you know. And it's just straight away, it's just the state, absolute state of what they bring. It's just madness. And all of these points that we're writing here, it's just like it has been written about today. Not to a certain extent, not as severe, but we're on that road, aren't we? We're on that path, and you can see sort of little nuggets of similarity, comparison.
Well, they're putting the Afghans up in the hotel, in this hotel, which people are going on holiday to, which people pay a lot of money to go on holiday to there. And then you've got our administration that are putting the Afghans up there. So it is, you know, it's very similar to this, isn't it? Where it's saying the Egyptian people are running around poor, and, you know, the king is giving the money away to these foreign countries.
Yeah, and they're paying top dollar as well, top premier price.
Yeah, well, and while we've got homeless on the streets as well,
yeah,
that could really do with being put up in a hotel.
I mean, it just begs the question, why? How is it truly benefiting society? And, you know, the only conclusion is there's an alternate agenda. They are looking literally to cause civil unrest, division and just disorder, really. It's like, if you want to ruin a country, what do? And you do exactly what this government's doing, you know. You look at countries like China, not that I agree with a lot of their policies, but they are quite nationalistic in many respects. And, you know, they put their own first, at least.
I think there's a fair bit of incompetence in there as well, and arrogance. And thinking, well, that can't possibly be right. Those nationalists can't possibly be right, when we are right, and we're pointing out, you know, that things are basically repeating themselves, and there's nothing new under the sun, and the same thing has gone on in, you know, all these civilizations before that we see going on today. I think incompetence does play into it, and you've also got groups that stand to benefit from there being chaos and division. And I think every other group in the world understands that there is a competition between all the various groups, and they work to work for the benefit of their group, and we're the only group that don't. And of course, it benefits the other groups to weaken the groups around them. So if they can weaken our group, they're going to do that, aren't they? It's only natural. It's just, you know, survival of the fittest. So they're going to do that.
Yeah.
And yet we seem to think that nobody's going to do that, and we don't need to look out for our interests. I don't know why we think that, whether we think who we think is going to look out for our interests if we're not doing that. But we seem to have forgotten about this struggle, you know, life and death struggle of nature, and we've given up on it.
I think a lot of the mainstream narrative doesn't really paint the picture of us and them, do they? They kind of, you know, they make the basically they make out that we're all one, we're all in it together, and we need to blend. And that I don't think people are aware of the actual, you know, the true nature of things, that we don't just intrinsically get on, and there's going to be conflicts, and people just ignore the facts. Same thing with what's going on with COVID today. People are just ignoring the facts and the reality just for the ideological kind of beliefs that just are so far from rooted nature. That's what's causing a lot of the problem.
I think it's probably the same going on back then in Egypt. They were probably telling them that these are great people. These are really helping us. This diversity is a strength. And look at this next bit. What is it that one could do? Behold, it is in the hands of those who did not know it, as well as those who knew it. Foreigners are now skilled in the work of the Delta. So what they've done, they've actually taught the foreigners how to do the work and how to do things, and they've trained them. And he's saying it's in the hands of those who did not know it, as well as those who did know it. So he's saying that you have some incompetence there and people that didn't know that this is what was actually going on. And then you've got others that did know that what was going to happen, and they deliberately did it. They deliberately did it anyway. So again, that's the same as today, isn't it?
Yeah. What's the work of the Delta? What's that mean?
That's working in the bit there by the Mediterranean, in the fertile bit,
Delta is a location.
Yeah, Delta is a location. So whatever the work was that was done in the Delta, they've taught foreigners how to do it. Foreigners are now reaping the benefits of the work that went on in the Delta. And don't forget also, it was the Delta where the Hyksos were. And Joseph and his people and the Egyptians were centered around Thebes, which is lower down. So the genuine Egyptians were sandwiched between the Nubians in the south and the Hyksos in the north. And the Hyksos were in the Delta, and the Egyptians, they were in Thebes. So, this is the same situation that when Joseph was there with the foreigners that were in the Delta. He says, why, really, the children of nobles are abandoned in the streets. He who knows says, yes, it is so. The fool says, no, it is not. It is fair in the sight of he who knows not. So there are people speaking up saying, this is what is going on. And then they've got fools saying, no, this isn't what's going on. It's great. Look how wealthy us poor guys are now. And then in the sight of those who really don't know very much, they think it's fair. They think, oh, this is great. This is wonderful. Those who watch the television and get all their information from the BBC, they think it's all fine. It's all fair. It's great what's going on.
That's it. It just strikes me as being a classic case of left and right, doesn't it?
Yeah, I just find it incredibly similar to what's going on today. And the final bit, so Lower Egypt weeps. And of course, that's where the Egyptians were, is in Lower Egypt, and the Hyksos were in Upper Egypt. The storehouse of the king is a mere come and get it for everybody, and the entire place is without taxes. So this has to be after Joseph, because Joseph invented the idea of the taxation, and he used the taxes to win back the lands from the Hyksos and from the lands that were about. So at some point after that, the Egyptians have lost the lands again, basically.
Yeah, for sure, definitely.
I mean that's what it's saying.
Yeah, that's the strongest case. I think I'll have to link you the articles that I've been reading, and then try and piece together where they might fit in.
Yeah, I saw some of them, but I mean, they were sort of linking it in with the plagues of Egypt. But I mean, he's quite clear that what the cause of this is, it's foreigners and barbarians that have come into Egypt. And I guess what the people that are looking at it trying to say that it was to do with the Exodus. I mean, they may be saying, well, these foreigners that came in, that was the Israelites. But the Israelites were on the side of the Egyptians. Don't forget, they were on the side of the Egyptians. By the time we get to Moses, you've got one of these foreign types is the Pharaoh, and he's calling himself Pharaoh, and that's what the Hyksos did. They gave themselves all the trappings of the Egyptians, and they took on their customs. They didn't bring any customs of their own with them. They just took on the customs that the Egyptians had.
Yeah, so I guess the Hebrew people really were steeped in their own customs and tradition, and they would have stuck to it. And that's what pretty much the Bible says, doesn't it? They kind of maintain their own culture and identity, really, whilst living there.
Yeah, and they lived in a separate area. I mean that finishes with the Ipu hyperverb it, but maybe the next bit, which I've got here, maybe this illuminates some of this for us. After retreating south, the native Theban kings found themselves trapped between the Canaanite Hyksos ruling the north and the Hyksos-Nubian allies to the south. After years of vassalage, Thebes finally gathered enough strength to challenge the Hyksos in a conflict that lasted for more than 30 years, until 1555 BC. The kings Sekwenenra Tau II and Karmosi were ultimately able to defeat the Nubians to the south of Egypt, but they failed to defeat the Hyksos. That task fell to Karmosi's successor, Amosi I, who successfully waged a series of campaigns that permanently eradicated the Hyksos presence from Egypt. And this is the pharaoh that Clifton Emmerhiser believes that Joseph worked for. He established a new dynasty, and in the new kingdom that followed, the military became a central priority for the kings who sought to expand Egypt's borders and attempted to gain mastery of the Near East. Unfortunately, much of this was later achieved through intermarriage with these other tribes, particularly Hittite and Hurrian princesses. So after this point, they managed to throw the Hyksos off. And it had to have been that the Hyksos were actually there when Ipuwer is writing, because, I mean, he's saying Lower Egypt weeps, and Lower Egypt is where the Egyptians were. I mean, as it tells us here, the native Theban kings, they were trapped between the Hyksos ruling the north and the Nubian allies to the south, in Nubia, not actually in Egypt, but in Nubia. So you've got Lower Egypt, you've got Nubia, Lower Egypt, and then Upper Egypt with the Hyksos in it. So when Ipuwer is talking, it's at some point during that stage when this happened. And then you get Amosi is the one that finally gets rid of the Hyksos. And Clifton believes that he was the pharaoh that Joseph worked for. And then you've got another 200-400 years until you actually get to Moses.
Yeah. The Nubians, they were more black, weren't they?
They were black.
Yeah. So that explains really why there kind of was a lot of mixed race within Egypt after that, because you do see a kind of a mixed lineage in some of the artifacts. I think that's why a lot of people kind of get confused, don't they, when looking back at ancient Egypt, because especially like a lot of blacks that say, you know, we were the kings, the Kangs, you know, they see themselves or similarities. They weren't fully reminiscent of a typical, you know, black phenotype, but you can see some of the injection there.
Yeah, the Nubians actually did take over Egypt, but it wasn't for long. I think it was for about 100 years or 150 years. So for a short period, you did have the Nubians that were styling themselves as pharaoh. So you do get representations of them. I mean, it was really sort of the fall of Egypt was after this. As I say, there was interbreeding with these Hurrians and the Hittites. And we'll get into, when we get to Akhenaten, you'll see that he had lots of genetic defects. And then we get to Tutankhamun. And it was all multicultural from then on, really, until Alexander the Great came in there and reinvigorated everything. And, of course, he came in from the from the Balkans.
Yeah, he's probably one of... he's such a legend, really. I don't think people realise how much of an impact he had on the world, especially Europeans today.
We got so much to get into with this series on Egypt. I mean, there really is so much there. There'll be another few episodes on it yet anyway, and it's exciting stuff, I think. Well, I think we'll have to leave that there then, Patriarch. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.